today's episode of the Health Tree Podcast for Multiple Myeloma, a show that connects patients with myeloma researchers. I'm your host, Jenny Alstrom, and we'd like to thank our episode sponsor, GSK, for their support of this program. Now, before we get started with today's show, I'd like to remind you to join Health Tree Connect if you haven't already. Health Tree Connect is our own social media platform that's part of the Health Tree suite of patient tools. So if you participate in the Health Tree community chapter events, or even if you don't, you can connect and chat with other myeloma patients in these groups. You can find this Health Tree Connect by going to healthtree.org/myeloma and then clicking on apps and programs in the menu bar. So it's similar to Facebook in function, where you can post questions or comments, comment or react to someone else's post, or add videos or photos to a post. And users can subscribe to certain groups, which will put those conversations in your feed. We now have over 1,700 users in Health Tree Connect, and at the end of June, we will have a phone-based app for that and our other programs, so keep an eye out for that. Now, on to our show. There are a host of new or up-and-coming blood-based tests that are being used to track a patient's myeloma. Now, this is definitely more convenient for patients than the unfortunately dreaded bone marrow biopsy. So our show today is to learn about these different options from Dr. Ola Landgren, head of the myeloma program at the University of Miami. Dr. Landgren, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to join here today.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And let me give an introduction for you before we get started. Dr. Landgren is professor of medicine at the University of Miami and head of the program at the University of Miami. Prior to his appointment, he was head of the program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor at Weill Cornell Medical College and at the National Cancer Institute, and Karolinska University Hospital in Sweden, where he is from. He is an author on over 430 publications and has received the American Society of Clinical Investigation Award and many NCI awards, including the NCI Research Highlights Award, the Bench to Bedside Award, the Intramural Award, and the Director's Intramural Innovation Research Award. At the University of Miami, he's built an astounding team, truly astounding, with specific focus on the genetics of multiple myeloma to establish a risk profile for newly diagnosed patients, precursor condition work on MGUS and smoldering myeloma, and so much more. I'm just so impressed with what you have done, building a program really from scratch.
Thank you. You're very kind, Jenny. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, let's get started with these different tests. And I think it might be helpful to just kind of use the same format and go through the different tests and have you help us explain what the tests are and how they work, why and when you would use them, if they're available today, and then kind of pros and cons of these different tests. You and I had a conversation about this, and it was so helpful for me, and I thought it would be very helpful for other patients because they hear about these tests, but they don't, you know, it's hard to keep them all straight, actually. So let's start with maybe the MRD-based tests. So maybe we should start with the binding site test.
Yeah, so first of all, I would like to say when it comes to all these tests, I have no financial relationship. I have no favorite assay, so I'm working in the research setting, and I'm also working, obviously, in the clinical and translational setting. So when we talk about this binding site test, what we are talking in a little bit broader context is about a mass spec technology. And mass spec is something that's been around for a very long time. And what happens specifically in the binding site, and there are other related assays as well that work in a similar manner, is that a very small amount of serum can be used. So serum comes from peripheral blood. You can take a blood tube. You can take out a very small amount of serum. And you can send laser beams in this mass spec machine through the sample. And the way mass spec technology works is that it uses laser beams to go through different types of liquids to determine whether there are certain structures or not. And you can have it looking for, in this case, different types of proteins. So when people talk about the binding site technology, how that works is that you take a sample, you typically would put it in a little plate that has many wells. and you would split the sample into several wells. Typically, people have done, say, 5 wells. And then you let the machine send laser beams through each of these wells and ask the question whether it can identify abnormal proteins or not. And the machine can then answer that, and it can actually do it very fast. So with these technologies, if you use a particular type of mass spec instrument that's called MALDI TOF mass spec machines, each well can be buzzed by these lasers in only 10 seconds. And if you have 5 of them as replicates, you make sure you see the same thing. We are talking about 50 seconds, so it's less than a minute. So it's very fast. Mm-hmm. The total time from preparing a sample, if you do a blood draw on a human being and you want to put it in this machine, there are obviously many more steps. You have to prepare the sample. You have to do many different steps. So it doesn't take just 50 seconds from the blood draw to have the results, but the actual assay in the machine is very fast. What I also should say is that what this type of approach really is looking for is not that very different from what you're looking for when you use immunofixation or SPET tests, that are standard tests we have had for many, many years. It's looking for the abnormal monoclonal proteins. You can also look for free light chains. So these are tests that we would normally look for with regular blood tests, as everyone knows. So the difference is that instead of using the technologies with electrophoresis or other type of nephelometers that are used, different types of established technologies, this type of approach uses the laser, the mass spec technology. So what that does is that increases the sensitivity. So you can basically look for fragments of the immunoglobulin. So you look for smaller pieces, and that means that you are more able to identify lower levels. So more sensitive, faster, and pretty neat way of doing it. That's kind of a simple way of saying it.
Mm-hmm. Understand. Now, why would you use it and when would you use it? And we didn't really talk in the beginning, but that I should back up a little bit, just about overall usage. Like, why are these blood-based tests being further developed instead of just using the bone marrow biopsy?
So the question is, why are these tests used instead of bone marrow biopsy?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you mentioned in the beginning of the introduction here, the bone marrow biopsies are quite unpleasant ways of capturing information. You have to do a biopsy. It's painful and it's an invasive procedure. So if you can use blood, if that could replace the need for a biopsy, I think most patients for sure would like it, and of course all doctors and everyone else involved. So I think it's just for the feasibility and the inconvenience of biopsy to try to go away from that. But I don't think we are yet at the point where we can say that this type of technology really truly can replace the biopsy, because in order to come to that point, you need to generate a lot of data. You need to show that if you're looking for minimal residual disease detection, that you have followed a large number of patients and you have the information from the bone marrow, and then you have the information, for example, with this technology, and you show that there is concordance. So if, say, if you test 100 patients and 99 of them, you get the same results, that's a very good outcome of the study. But if you test 100 patients and only 50 of them are concordant, that's not going to work. So that type of work is still ongoing. We don't have the formal results from comparisons between bone marrow-based MRD tests and these types of assays. There are a lot of other details that could be discussed in the setting of what are you actually tracking and how does that work. So what I mean with that is, if you do a bone marrow biopsy, you look for cells or DNA, and you can answer yes or no, detectable, or you can quantify what you see. With these proteins, you're not looking for cells, you're looking for proteins. But the proteins come from the cells. So that's important to remember, that if you have a patient that you treat with very effective therapy, let's say you can completely eradicate the cells, and you do a biopsy and there are no cells to be found, among the last things those cells did before they kind of went away with the therapy was that they cranked out a lot of protein. And protein can stay in the body for quite a long time. So if you, at the same time as you do that bone marrow biopsy, also do a blood test and you look for protein, you probably will see protein. So you're going to have one bone marrow test saying negative, and then you're going to have a protein test saying positive. So if you just look at it that way, you're going to say, oh, these are not consistent, they're not concordant. Well, you're not looking at the same thing. You're looking at proteins that were released by the cells that are no longer there. So that takes a lot of additional things into consideration. You have to probably look at the slopes of these. So if you check the protein in a few weeks again, if they continue to decay, to go away, and it mimics the pattern of clearance, then you would say that these proteins really are not being continued to be made. They are just part of the washout of the clearance in the body. So as you hear me saying, these are a little bit complicated things, and there is more research that needs to be done to really determine how the clearance patterns really look in a person who do not continue to make protein. And there is more work that has not been done yet.
Yeah, it sounds like you may have to just, like what you're saying, just see that slope over time, and is it going down and is it gone? So the bindings that you explained how this test works and why you would use it. This is the mass spec tests are considered MRD tests, correct? Because I think sometimes patients hear mass spec and they don't really understand the context of those types of tests, but they are, correct?
Well, I think you could say yes to that, but you could also broaden the scope and say that what really makes a test qualified to be called an MRD test, you maybe could say that most tests could be viewed as MRD tests, because really when we talk about MRD tests, what we mean is that we use them to make sure that there is no residual disease. So could you use flow cytometry as an MRD test? Could you use sequencing-based technologies? Could you use protein-based technologies? There are so many different ways, and more than that, you could use imaging-based technologies. You heard me talking before at another mm-hmm. of your programs about images that are immunopath-based. So that's another way of going after MRD tests. So yes, the mass spec test could be put in that category. But I think the way I think about it is that it's basically a modern way to use mass spec technology to rule out presence, absence of residual disease in the blood. I do think the caveat I mentioned, that there is a delay clearance, that is something that probably can be handled if there is better knowledge on the slopes of the clearance. But there is more work, as I mentioned, to be done. But already now, these technologies are probably very, very powerful. There is more work to be done for that as well, but they are probably very, very powerful for early detection or recurrences. Because if there is nothing, there is nothing, there is nothing, and then all of a sudden there is something, they are much more sensitive than any of the other blood tests that are currently available, like SPEP, IFEs, and free light chains. The dilemma that this type of technology is facing is the fact that the proteins that are made are in the body after the cells have been eradicated. So that is what I'm trying to highlight, on the fact that you have the slope of the clearance, where you could actually mathematically model and show that if the slope goes down with a certain rate, all you see is just delayed clearance. But we need to have more computational models to really do that in a reliable way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about how this is. So you would use this to, like you said, to just rule out the presence or absence of residual disease in the blood. So you're using it after treatment typically, right? And you wouldn't need to use it prior to treatment because you have a big load that you can detect, you know, like on IFE or the regular monoclonal protein test. So is that the only time that you would use it, is following a treatment and looking for the depth of remission? Or are there other times that you might use this test?
Yeah, so this test that we are talking about, so also for full clarification, to say you mentioned the binding site technology. The binding site is now part of the Thermo Fisher Corporation, and there are other technologies as well. I mentioned that Mayo Clinic has their own technology that they are commercially selling. They have a huge commercial laboratory in Rochester, Minnesota, and there are other labs as well. There are other groups that are working, and we have no favorites. They are all doing a good job. But they are very similar to each other, these types of technologies. Yeah, so what could you use them for? Could you only use them for MRD tracking, or could you also use these tests just in someone who is newly diagnosed? Could you use it to track in someone who is on therapy? Could it be used in someone who has relapsed myeloma? The answer is yes, you could, because these technologies, they can track the protein, they can identify them. And what all these different companies and initiatives I mentioned and others are doing is that they are trying to see how they, with computer models, can use the data to quantify the size of the protein. So a practical aspect is if you have your SPEP, you have your IFEs, you have your light chain assays, and here comes another assay, the mass spec. So is this another assay, or is this an assay that potentially could replace the other? So it would be great if this just replaced everything. So that would mean that you could have a more sensitive assay. But what needs to be done there, the remaining work that really needs to be done, is that the quantification component of this type of assay, meaning that you run it and it will tell you 2.1 grams per deciliter, that needs to be further improved, or that you say that there is a light chain concentration with kappa of 12.8 milligrams per deciliter, let's say. So that is where the technology needs to further be developed in terms of the computational side. And there is a lot of work already done. These assays I mentioned and others have already done a lot of work, but I think what needs to be done is to show that this is completely reproducible, and if you do the same test in different locations, in different laboratories, that the results continue to show the same thing. And this is typical for assay development. It takes time to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and I will be asking you about different types of tests, so by name sometimes, because sometimes patients, we hear the names, and then we don't understand the context or how they might be, one might be different than the other or better than the other. So this is just an example to start, and then we will move on to different tests. So hopefully that's okay.
Yeah.
So any pros and cons on the binding site test in particular? You said it was very fast, the method.
Yeah, I think that the pros is that it's very fast, and I mentioned that you can load a plate. Usually those plates, they're kind of pre-made or used for many different types of machines. So the type of machines that are running these plates usually take plates that can have up to 96 wells in a plate. So that means that you can put, I mentioned five replicates. You can put five replicates times many patients, and that would then feed into this plate. And then if you have a large laboratory, you can do one plate, a second, a third, and fourth, and so forth. Plates. So it's basically a very high throughput technology. So if you have a very large lab, you could probably crank out the same amount of results that an SPEP, an IFE, maybe would take five people. That could be done with just one person running the machine. So it's a very efficient technology. But if you have a small number of samples, it's going to probably be about the same staff running it, because you need to have people to do lower volume with either of the platforms. But the technology has its scalability potential, if you want. And then from a sensitivity point of view, I think it probably is between 10 and 100 times more sensitive than SPEP and IFE. And although you, in theory, could think that it could be even more sensitive, the dilemma is the fact that this is looking for fragments of immunoglobulins, and you're looking for fragments of the abnormal proteins. But in the blood, there are a lot of normal proteins. Every human being has a lot of albumin, and then we all have also normal immunoglobulins. So from a lab perspective, what we are talking about is that there is a background noise. And what we want to pick up is the signal. What we don't like is the noise. And when you're starting to go very low concentrations, and also when you look in the light chain myelomas versus the ones with M spikes, you run more and more into these problems from a methodological point of view with the noise. So the technology still has some room for continued improvement to improve some of these details, I would say. But it is a very, very powerful technology. So cons are that I think that there is more work to be done, but that's true for many things in life and in medicine and things in general. And also a cons is the fact that you are tracking something that is not linked to here and now. It's something that is linked to what happened in the past. And what I mean with that is the cells I mentioned, if you eradicate them, say you give CAR T cell therapy, you give DARA-KOD or some very powerful therapy, teclistamab or some other bispecific antibody, although the cells can be wiped out in just a month, let's say, the protein will probably be there for many months. So if you're trying to see if you got rid of the disease, the proteins, they are going to stay in the body for a longer time because they take time to be cleared by the body. So you need to have computer systems that can tell you that the rate of this, the decay, the decrease in concentration over time is consistent with what you would expect to see in someone who's just clearing out a given concentration. You want to make sure that there is no additional protein being made, which would indicate that there is residual disease. So that is sort of a, what I would call an inherent limitation with these protein assays, that you are looking for something that is not linked directly. It's an indirect measure of the disease. So you need to have computerized systems in order to be able to read what you're seeing, what that really means. For tracking of someone over time who's someone who's negative, or if you want to rule out that there is no reoccurrence of disease, that's a whole other story. So if it's negative and it continues to be negative, that's what we want to see. That's great. And these could be like very early warning systems. Then you don't have this dilemma, because once the protein is eradicated and has been cleared from the body, if it continues to be negative, that's what we want to see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, makes sense. And the over time tracking makes complete sense for that test. Well, let's move on to the Sebia test. That's also a mass spec test, correct? Or no?
Yes, it is. And the Sebia technology, there is also, I want to be very inclusive here. I am a very inclusive person. I have no favorites. Food for drugs, for technology, for anything. I usually say I have no loyalty. I just want the best. So I want the best for my patients. So if a drug company comes or a technology company comes, I tell them always the same thing, that you have nothing to worry about. As long as you have the best option for my patients, I will use it. So CBI is one of the good options. There is also a technology up in Toronto in Canada that has been developed by the university there, Prince Margaret's Hospital, and there are others as well. And they are different from the ones that we just talked about in that sense that they are not looking for the fragments of the whole immunoglobulins or the light chain. What these technologies are doing is that they're actually looking for peptides that are much smaller protein structures. So amino acids make peptides, and peptides make antibodies. That's kind of the order of how these proteins are linked to each other. Everything goes down to this amino acid, the CGAT, and then you make the peptides, and then the peptides form structures like immunoglobulins or free light chains. So these technologies are looking at that intermediate step of the peptides. So one of the key strengths with this is that you can actually, if you know the sequence of the disease for a given patient, you then know which of the peptides you're going to look for. So the first technology I mentioned is just screens for fragments of abnormal proteins. But mm-hmm. if you look for peptides, you can actually see, is this peptide there, yes or no? So it's a patient-specific technology. It's looking for smaller kind of units of protein, if you want. And because you do it that way, that means that you don't run into this issue with the background noise, because you know what you're looking for. And if you see it there, then you know it's disease. So it's more precise. So it probably is in the range of 100 to maybe 1,000 times more sensitive than SPEP and IFE. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, so, amazing.
So what are the kind of the strengths and weaknesses with this technology? As we hear me saying, mm-hmm. if you have a patient-specific approach, that's fantastic. You can track. You don't have the noise. But the downside with that is that how do you know the individual patient sequence? So until quite recently, that has been a big hurdle with these technologies. So you used to have to do a bone marrow biopsy and to get the sequence from sequencing. But with very creative work by scientists in the field, it actually is now possible to take a very small amount of serum to determine the sequence just from the serum. You don't need to do the biopsy. So you can a small amount of serum, you run it in this technology, and then you can determine the individual patient's sequence, and then you can ask the computer, tell me which are the 10 most common peptides that are linked to this peptide. And now you have, or whatever number the machine tells, but I think it's 10 for now. That's how these technologies are developed for now. This could change in the future. So now you know what to track. And then if you take a very small amount, we are talking like a few microliters, 5 or 10 microliters of serum, which is technically nothing. You can ask the laser in the mass spec machine, can you find this protein? Yes, no, or these proteins. And if it does, then you have positive, negative. So it is a more sensitive approach. It doesn't have the issue of background. It's much more precise. The cons with this is that you need to determine the baseline sample, but you can do it from serum. So if you do it at baseline in someone who is newly diagnosed or someone who still has detectable disease, you will get it out of these technology platforms that can do it in blood, in serum. The inherent cons, as I mentioned before, for the mass spec in general is that you are looking for something that was made by cells that no longer may be around. So you will always have this issue when, if you're looking for proteins. But you could also model the clearance here. And if you see that the proteins go away and they follow the same trajectory as they would in a typical clearance situation, you can say there is no indication, or there's a 95% probability that this follows the slope of delayed clearance. So there is no indication that there is new protein being made. I think that's where these technologies are going to land. You can also track people over time, as I mentioned, and you could have early warning systems for reappearance of disease.
Okay, I'm taking notes. Makes sense. Okay, yeah, all these different methods are very interesting, and I think it's good for patients to understand. So if they start hearing names of things or, like, I didn't know that Mayo Clinic had their own test that was similar to the other test. So this is what patients are hearing kind of, you know, randomly, and I think they need to put it in context, so this is super helpful. Okay, can we talk about the adaptive clonoSEQ test? Because they had the MRD test that was bone marrow-based, and now they have a blood-based test. I don't think it's FDA-approved yet, but I think it's CLIA-approved. So can you explain what that is and how it works and how it's different than the other two methods that you just explained?
Yeah, so the adaptive biotech clonoSEQ test is a technology that has been developed over a longer period of time. And it's based on the fact that the immune cells in the body, they have an ability to adapt to different types of antigens that enter our body. So the immune system obviously is a very important part of our bodies to keep us away, keep us out of trouble. So if there are infections or different types of threats that happen in our bodies, the immune system would attack it and get rid of it. And the way that works is that there are certain regions of the genetic program in our bodies that can adapt and reshuffle parts of the sequences to make sure that the body matches up with that threat and then eliminates it. So it's very, you can say it's very plastic. It sees something particular, it adjusts for that, and then it builds up more of these responses, and then it goes after that. So if you sequence a lot of B cells that are part of the immune system, you will see that there are very many different sequences. There are many, 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 many of these sequences. And that's basically because we are constantly exposed to different types of things. There are antigens, there are bacteria, and viruses, and food, and everything in our kind of environment where we live and when we are active and doing things. All those things are constantly being checked off by the immune system. So what the technology that Adaptive is using is based on is this very principle, that the B cells, they respond. And what was discovered years ago is that if you have a malignant process, such as multiple myeloma, that is a process that for an individual patient shares killer sequence. That by itself is very fascinating, and it probably is something that we need to spend more time thinking about, because that means that there is something unique that triggered the onset of the clone of the disease in a given patient. So there is something that seems to be consistent in all the cells within a given person with multiple myeloma that is unique. And then these cells have copied up, like to many, many, many copies. And if you perform more sophisticated sequencing, you can see that many of these cells look very different from each other. In fact, there are usually thousands of different mutations you can see. And if you perform single cell sequencing, you can see that these mutations that you can find are not the same across these different cells. But this very sequence that I mentioned in the beginning that is unique for the B-cell response is also called VDJ. And that is part of this plastic part of the immune system. So although there is a huge what's called genetic heterogeneity of the cells within a given person with myeloma, there are many different mutations in different cells that are not in other cells. They have a lot of mutations, but they are not the same. The very VDJ sequence is the same in all the cells, which is very peculiar. So that means that you now have a fingerprint that's unique to the patient, that is unique to the disease. What we and others have done, we have studied these signatures, and we have seen patients were treated, they were MRD negative, and unfortunately, if there was a recurrence years later, we picked up again the disease, and we showed that the fingerprint of this VDJ was identical. And we have seen people who went back to MRD negativity, and unfortunately, there could be a recurrence many, many years later. And again, this signature did not change. And we have followed people for over 10 years, and the signature is the same. Wow. So the biology of myeloma lends itself for tracking of this VDJ, because once that's there, that doesn't seem to change or go away. That's basically what Adaptive does. So in order to do that in a practical way, because what I said, that all the B cells have their unique signature, if you just do a bone marrow biopsy of someone who is completely healthy, you will see millions of sequences, which is just reflective of how all the B cells are reacting to different things. But now if you do it on someone who is newly diagnosed with myeloma, the difference would be between this healthy person that has millions of normal sequences is that the person who has myeloma has millions of sequences that represent the normal immune system. But then there is one sequence that has many, many, many millions and millions and millions of copies, and those are the myeloma cells.
Mm-hmm.
And if you treat this person and the person is being tested at a later time point, If you didn't know what sequence to look for because you didn't perform the baseline test, after treatment has been completed, you don't know which could be the sequence that is like the one that is the clone, the disease. So even if there were just very few cells hanging around, you would not be able to tell if this is background or if this is disease. So that's why you need, for these types of tests, the adaptive clonoSEQ assay. You need to know the baseline samples. You know what to look for. And if you do that, you can ask in a sample after treatment, can we still detect the sequence, yes or no? And how many copies are there? And you can track it over time. And also, there are, of course, a lot of more details here as well. There can be more than one sequence. There could be two sequences or three sequences, but many cases have only one sequence. It could be one or two or some very low number. And then you can track them over time.
And how does the blood-based, the adaptive clonoSEQ blood-based test differ from the adaptive clonoSEQ bone marrow-based test?
So the technology is the same, exactly the same. You're looking for these signatures. Mm-hmm. So the only difference is that you are looking to see if you can pick up the sequence in another part of the body. So instead of putting in a needle mm-hmm. in the bone marrow, you put a needle in the blood. Now, if you ask yourself, you have someone who is newly diagnosed with myeloma, and you do a bone marrow biopsy, you have a perfect sample, and then you do a perfect blood draw, perfect sample. And then you say, how many copies of this abnormal sequence do I find in the bone marrow per, say, 1 milliliter of blood as a unit? And then you do 1 milliliter of bone marrow. Well, the answer is that there will probably be 100 or 1,000 times more copies in the bone marrow because that's where the disease is. Not mm-hmm. all the disease will go out in the blood. So what that means in practical terms is that what you're looking for in the bone marrow, if you start looking for that same thing in the blood, you're making your life 100 to 1,000 times more difficult as a researcher, as a clinician, because that will be between 100 and 1,000 times less to look for. And if you have too small of a blood volume, you may end up with a negative result when you look in the blood, which could be either because there is no disease, or it could be that there are too few copies to reliably detect with this assay. So if you took out a whole liter of blood or like a very large volume of blood, you probably would be able to reliably do it. But of course, no one would like to do that. We only have 4.5 liters of blood in our body, so that would just never happen. So if you're talking about strengths and weaknesses, a weakness with the blood-based sequencing is that what we're looking for is less prevalent in the blood compared to the bone marrow, but it's still more sensitive than SPEP and IFE. So you could argue and say, maybe it's not that different in its sensitivity compared to, say, the MALDI TOF. We talked about the binding site and other technologies, the Mayo Clinic assay, et cetera. It's a sequencing-based technology. You don't have the issue of delayed clearance with the sequences. So maybe that could be another alternative.
Yeah, lots of nuances with the different tests. So that's why I think it's very helpful for you to help us understand like what they are and pros and cons. So no delayed clearance issue, but because it doesn't, like myeloma doesn't always leach out into the blood, or does it?
Well, the sequences will be detectable in the blood, I would say probably 99.9% of patients at diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I actually think it does. There are a lot of other granular things I didn't go through. So if you're trying to characterize the details of the disease, if you are not only looking for these VDJ that are sort of like genomic fingerprints for the immune trigger, if you're looking for other things, if you're looking for particular genes or mutational signatures or copy number variations or things, then the question becomes much more complicated because you could ask the question, are the cells or the DNA that ends up in the blood, are those representative of what's in the bone marrow? So what I mean with that is, if you think about, you have millions of different cells sitting in the bone marrow. What are the ones that are ending up in the blood like? Do they look like any random sample, or are there particular subsets of the ones in the bone marrow that are more prone to go out in the blood? And no one knows the answer to that. But because we don't know that, I think you have to be careful and say, if you profile the disease in the blood with more kind of disease-specific tests, do you know for sure that this is representative of the bone marrow? So that's a whole other question that goes way beyond MRD testing. That's like more molecular profiling.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think you'll have to see that over time, I guess, with more utility of these and more data and things like that.
Yep.
Now, this is a next-generation sequencing. You kind of explained how that's this, like, person's personal signature. How does that differ from the flow-based, like Euroflow or other flow-based? I know a lot of facilities have their own flow-based MRD testing. What's the difference between those, and what are some pros and cons with the flow-based MRD testing?
Yeah, the flow-based assays are very different from sequencing in that sense that they are not looking for the inside of the cells. They look for the outside of the cells. So all the cells in our bodies, they have a nucleus, and that's the center of the cell, and then they have the cytoplasm, and then they have their surface. And in the cytoplasm, inside, are a lot of functions that float around and do a lot of things. One thing that is very well known in myeloma, which is true in every cell, but in myeloma it's particularly important. For example, inside the cytoplasm, we have the proteasomes. And you have a lot of other things that have functions that help the cell function and do what it's supposed to do. On the surface of every cell in the body, there are many different proteins that are kind of attached there. We don't fully understand how all these things work, but part of the discovery has been done for years show that the cells could use some of these proteins to basically navigate in the body, that certain proteins would take cells to certain locations. They can use that to communicate with each other, and they can trigger functions between different types of cells. So it's a very fascinating and very sophisticated combination of things that these cells, cell surface proteins, they do. When we are talking about flow-based MRD testing, it's basically a way to run a sample through a machine when you are looking at individual, one cell at a time, markers of these proteins. And if you have spent time studying this, which a lot of people have done over the years, you know that myeloma cells, they do express a protein that's called CD38, which happens to be the same target for isatuximab and daratumumab, for example. And they usually express CD138, but they also express a lot of other markers. There is something called CD56. They usually do not, but they can express CD20. They usually do not express CD45. They may or may not express CD67, and so forth and so forth and so forth. So if you take a sample in a person who has myeloma and you look for these markers in one single person, what you will see that many of these markers are present and many of these markers are not so present or just a little bit present. You will also see that within a given person that some cells, but not all of them, have certain markers and some don't. So that makes it very complicated if you're trying to use a technology that looks for markers on the surface and use that as a way to determine if there is residual disease or not. Because what happens is the cell you're looking for does or does not express the particular protein you're now after. So people have then spent a lot of time thinking about it, and we have worked on this also for many years, and the Euroflow, and it really started in the UK with a group in Leeds in the UK, and other groups have worked on it as well. The NCI group, the Sloan Kettering group, the Mayo group, a lot of groups have worked on this. And what people have agreed to is that you need to have at least 10 different markers to look for. If you only look for one marker, if that is positive, it's positive. But if it's negative, it could either be really true negative, it could also be false negative. But if you have at least 10 markers, if they are all negative, that is negative. So basically, it's a way to rule out the false negatives. So if you have those 10 markers, then you can reliably rule out. And you also need to look through a large number of cells. You cannot just look through, say, 10,000 cells and say, I didn't find any. There is nothing. So people have said you need to look through a certain number of cells, and it's in the range of a few million cells, so between 1 and 3 million in that type of range. So now we are basically talking about enforcing rules for how to use technology that's basically available in literally every hospital these days. So all places have flow machines. So when you use flow cytometry, it's more a matter of which markers you look for and how you do it. Because if you do the wrong markers or you don't do enough markers, you don't do the right number of cells, if you read negative, what about false negative? You need to really reliably be able to say that this is done the right way. And that's where there has been a lot of controversy in the field. The European group in Spain, they patented this, and they call it Euroflow. They call it other names. They call it they wanted it to sound like next-generation sequencing. They call it next-generation flow. But all of this is 10-color flow cytometry that was standardized. Other groups call it other things. But it's basically a more standardized, very sensitive way of doing flow cytometry. These days, we have the same technology as Sloan Kettering has. It's a 12-color technology. You could have 20 or 50 colors, but what we and others for now believe is that if you add beyond the 12 markers, that it's not going to be more sensitive unless we come up with some new insights. So the pros here is that technology is available everywhere. There are agreements on how to do it. It's very fast. You can have a sample in the morning and you have the results in the afternoon. The downside is that it takes a lot of bandwidth to do all these things I told you, and you need to really stick to the same principles over and over and over and over again. And it technically may be probably 10 times less sensitive than sequencing. But there are benefits with this technology also. If you really do it very, very well, and you have high volume, and you know what you're doing, you could argue that this is also a good test to have.
And this is only bone marrow-based, or is this blood-based also?
It's the same exact thing as I spoke about for the adaptive clonoSEQ. You could apply it to anything, so you can look in the blood, but the same principle applies, that there is much less disease in the blood. So if you have a larger volume, you could compensate for it. But you could also say, I recognize that it's less sensitive, but it's still more sensitive than SPEP and IFEs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense. Okay, we have one more test to talk about, and then I'll open it up for caller questions. it's a lot. Circulating tumor cells. Can you explain what that test is? Because that's a blood-based test, and we're hearing about it kind of on the research side, but I don't know if people are using it in the clinic yet, but maybe you can explain what that is. I know Menarini is one of the companies, but there might be others that we can talk about.
Yeah, so as the name indicates, circulating tumor cells, it's looking for cells that have made their way into the bloodstream, and you can look for them there. Menarini is one of the systems. They already have an FDA clearance for solid tumors, and I think they're working also to get them approved in other areas. So this is a more sophisticated way of profiling cells than just looking for the VDJ, I mentioned the word fingerprint before, where you can look to see if you have the clone's kind of signature in a baseline sample, and then you track it over time, and you can say yes, no, or you can see number of copies. So with this type of technology, when you do circulating tumor cells, you can actually sequence the entire cell. So when people talk about, say, doing whole genome sequencing or single cell sequencing in the bone marrow, what people are doing is that you can run the whole code, or you can identify, characterize the whole code. If you do whole genome sequencing, you take a sample, you extract the DNA, you run it through the sequences, you get the sequence. If you do single cell, you do the same thing, but you do it for individual cells. So for the first approach is what people also call bulk sequencing, where you get like everything from a given sample, while the single cell is for individual cells. they have a lot of pluses and minuses, and we probably need to spend a few more hours talking about this today, which we don't have. But when you look at circulating tumors in the blood, when you look at circulating cells in the blood, you're looking for individual cells. So as you hear me saying, this gives you much, much more information. So let's say that you can identify that there are mutations and that are okay, and NRAS and BRAF mutations, or there are a lot of markers that you can identify in a given sample. But you heard me saying before when I was talking about, when you asked me, do they all patients have detectable disease in the blood? And I said yes, but I also said we don't really know if the blood sample is representative of the bone marrow. So a potential caveat to these technologies is that what you find in the blood, we don't know if that really captures the whole picture of what's going on in the bone marrow. That's something we don't know. Another limitation with these technologies, similar to all the other technologies, is that you have much less of the disease in the blood. So if you basically do 1,000 patients with these technologies in the bone marrow, and then you do those same 1,000 cases in the blood at diagnosis, you probably find the disease in the bone marrow and the blood in the vast majority of cases. But if you treat and you're looking for residual disease in the bone marrow and you do it in the blood, that will be a high proportion of those cases in the blood that's going to be negative, and it will probably be false negative. The same is true if you use these technologies to track disease in the blood in patients with precursor disease, with monoclonal gammopathy or smoldering myeloma. And Dana-Farber has shown in their PROMISE study in multiple presentations that they have up to 50% of patients have no information in some of their presentations because the assay doesn't work always when you have low levels. I'm sure this is going to get better. I know they and others, and we also are working on this to see how these technologies can get better and better by enriching the samples for what you want to look for, the cells. So this is also technology development. So I'm sure we're going to come to a point where we will be able to use these technologies also in the blood for the majority of patients with precursor disease.
Yeah, well, I guess my final question would be, how do you look at these as a researcher, but also as a clinician in your practice, using these or not using these, and where do you see that headed in the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, so our take, I have absolutely, as I said before, I have no intention of, I have no favorites. I have no intention whatsoever to tell anyone else what to do. I can share with you what we do. So
sure.
I have been in Miami for about 2.5 years. When I came here, my goal was, and it still is, to make sure we are one of the top 3 myeloma centers in the U.S. within 5 years of our start. And we have done about 2.5 years. So what we are doing this year is that we are actually implementing all these technologies that we have talked about today, both the MALDI-TOF, the clonotypic peptides, and also the circulating tumor cells. And we want to make these available for all patients that come to our center. We want to use them for research purposes, and we ultimately want to use them for clinical tracking of patients. So we are opening up a large laboratory as we speak where we have all these platforms going. We're installing all these instruments right now. So we will be able to track patients. And what I want to do is to see how these assays perform in parallel and see where they really are useful. So the proof will always be in the pudding. So if you have a lot of data, if you have a lot of data points, you can compare the sequencing from the blood with the proteins in the blood, and you can also compare it with bone marrow testing. So that is kind of our approach, and I think there are other groups as well that are thinking about or doing similar work.
Well, I think that's the only way that we get to better utility, because you're gathering data and generating that with your patients. I'm just so impressed with what you've been building. Your team is amazing, and everybody has a different and unique specialty. And I think this folds very nicely also in with the genetics work that you're doing to, determine risk factors and potential prognosis based on some of these factors, and I just think what you're doing is amazing.
Well, thank you. You're way too kind. Well, it's just a lot of hard work. We're trying.
It is a lot of hard work, but we're glad that you're doing it. Okay, I'd like to open it up just for a few minutes of caller questions. So we have a question with caller that ends in 7368. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. Hello, doctor. And I have a question. Is there ever a case for using blood biopsies or liquid biopsies instead of bone marrow biopsy to diagnose a patient when MM is suspected, let's say in the elderly population, people who may have osteoporotic compression fractures, limited mobility? Is there ever a case for doing the liquid biopsy exclusive of the bone marrow biopsy in early stages?
That's a very good question you're asking. So the question is, could you replace the conventional workup with the bone marrow biopsy and just do a blood-based test? And I assume that you're thinking about this circulating tumor cell test I was talking about.
Yes,
so
I've heard.
I do think theoretically we could already do that today, because you can see if you have abnormal cells. You can determine if they are clonal or not. You can look for the signature and so forth. But there are a lot of things that the test currently will not be able to answer. It, for example, will not answer how many cells are there of the patient we are talking about carrying, say, 15 or 20% plasma cells, or is the patient having up to 90% of plasma cells, or any number in between. I just made this up right now. And also, there are other things that you wouldn't know in the bone marrow microenvironment, and you just only know if there is disease, and you can profile the disease. You can look for technically all the gains and losses and translocations that fission cytogenetics would do, and you could also do sequencing of it. So molecularly, you could characterize it, but you don't have those other numbers. And I think the field is probably not ready to do this because we are so used to have access to all this information. Mm-hmm. But I think that the work that is ongoing and will be continued to be done most likely will generate data that will give people more confidence that you can probably go this route. But there is basically more development work that is more clinical to prove that this could be a useful way. So I think you are on something important, but there needs to be more work before we can really can replay. So we're not yet there.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, great question.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate it so much. Okay, another caller ending in 2006. Go ahead with your question.
Yes. Yes, thank you so much, Doctor. I have actually a two-part question regarding the VDJ abnormal sequence that is found in MM patients. And the question is this same abnormal VDJ sequencing in the hematopoietic stem cells that are used for transplant? And if yes, would that then suggest that doing an allogenic transplant instead of an autologous transplant for high-risk patients?
That's another very good question. So what you're asking me is if you do a biopsy in someone who has multiple myeloma, you determine the VDJ signature of the clone, which is the sequence that has the most copies. Is that the same sequence that you find in the stem cells of the same person? The answer is no. If you profile the stem cells, you do not see the same sequence. For sure, you do not see it as a peak. I say that with a little bit of a caveat because no one really knows what is the true origin of multiple myeloma. Could there be like very low number of stem cells that are still there that give rise that are not plasma cells? So I guess it's theoretically possible that there could be some cells there in the background that could give rise. But if you collect stem cells from the peripheral blood, or even if you do it the old way from the bone marrow, if you do it the new way with regular leukapheresis, you take out the cells, if you sequence them for VGG, you will not see the same peak as you do in the myeloma cells. So that would not be a justification by itself to say that the allogeneic transplant is the right way. And I think usually people would say that allogeneic transplant should only be reserved for research studies because there is no convincing data that it's superior to autologous. And then, of course, you have all the CAR T cells coming and other therapies as well. So that's a much longer conversation. But the short answer to your question is no, it's not there in the majority of those cells.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, great question. Okay, well, since we're at time, I think we'll close. But Dr. Landgren, thank you so much for joining us today and explaining this very complicated topic. I think we'll end up hearing more about these blood-based tests and liquid biopsies. I know patients are looking forward to them very significantly. So we're just very grateful for you to join us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Jenny. It's always a pleasure working together with you. You do fantastic with your whole foundation. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And thanks to our listeners for listening to the HealthTree podcast for multiple myeloma. Join us next time to learn more about what's happening in myeloma research and what it means for you.